Welcome to the SaaS Sales Performance Podcast, the show for anyone wanting to be on the cutting edge of SaaS tech sales. We provide the tools you need to take advantage of the rapidly changing sales environment. We bring you the leading experts on the front lines of SaaS sales and distill down our famous masterclasses into bite-sized practical tips. Your hosts will be Ash Ali and Matt Milligan. And on this podcast, we'll be helping you transform your ability to sell more so you can smash your targets.
Welcome back to another episode of the SaaS Sales Performance Podcast. And really excited to have today's guest on the show. We are diving into the topic today of leadership. And today's guest is someone who has started his role, his sales career as an IC, has progressed into a leadership position. And we're going to be really diving into that transition today in terms of what that journey looks like and some of the kind of key learnings along the way. Today's guest is Liam Jones. Liam is the head of business development at Olio. Olio is an amazing tech for good organization that helps sustainably reuse food from supermarkets. And Liam, I'll let you explain more to our listeners today around the mission of Olio and the amazing work that you guys are doing here in the UK and beyond. Welcome to the show, Liam.
Great to be here.
Awesome. Really looking forward to diving into some of the topics. The question I usually like to ask is, given that most of us fall into a career in sales, what's your journey been and how did you get to where you are today?
Yeah, I very much fell into it. So coming out of university, my intention was to be a lawyer, studied history at university, had always thought that I was going to be a lawyer, pursued that for a little while after university, did my conversion course, that kind of thing, but realized that it just wasn't for me. I didn't enjoy it. I couldn't see a career for myself in the legal profession. I realized I needed to find something else to do while I made my mind up around the next move I was going to make. So I took a sales job to tide me over. I had some sales experience. So when I was at university, I worked for Shelter as a charity fundraiser. You know, those people with like the big coats asking for your bank details on the street. So I had some experience. Yeah, so I started selling like office equipment and tech software and all this kind of thing, like proper old school sales environment on the phones, 100 calls a day, management constantly breathing down my neck, making sure that I was hitting all my KPIs, not the most enjoyable working environment. And as I said, I had no intention of pursuing a career in sales. But in the meantime, I was volunteering for Olio, which was a very young company at that stage. This is back in sort of 2016-ish, 2017. I was volunteering as a food waste hero, which is a program that I now head up the business development of at Olio. And because I was volunteering, I was on the email list and I got an email one day saying they're looking for, Olio's looking to hire its first salesperson. I thought that sounded amazing. So I put my hand up, went and spoke to the founders, got the job, and yeah, I've been at Olio ever since. So coming up to 5 years now.
Amazing, man. Really interesting that you started off on the fundraising side. And I'd love to kind of dive into that a little bit because our office here at UHubs is in Shoreditch. And I'll often come out of Liverpool Street Station and I'll be approached by some of the fundraisers. I actually have been quite impressed by how some of them approach me, you know, and I've even kind of exchanged details with some of them and said, stay in touch, you know, like we're hiring. It feels like that's not too dissimilar to like a kind of door-to-door sales type environment. Talk us through some of the skills that you picked up during that experience.
So the number one is resilience. It's a really hard job. You're standing on a street corner, often in cold UK weather, quite hostile environments, lots of men in suits walking past you, telling you in no uncertain terms that they don't want to speak to you. Either that or just flat out ignoring you. So you have to develop a thick skin. You have to be quite self-motivated. And when you get somebody to stop, because that happens maybe once an hour, once every couple hours, you need to convert. Yeah, I'm the same as you. I will sometimes sit and watch charity fundraisers today. And yeah, if I'm hiring, it's one of the places I look.
What a great way to cut your teeth. We think about BDRs, sort of SDRs, and these entry-level sales positions. And you do need a ton of resilience, right? And it sounds like that's a pretty good way to build that up.
Yeah, absolutely.
So thinking about your times on the streets, Liam, you've then obviously moved into a really interesting position at Olio, building something that's very admirable. Share with our listeners a little bit more about the kind of vision at Olio, and I'd love to talk about the mission-driven approach that you guys got.
Yeah, absolutely. So Olio was founded in 2015, towards the tail end of 2015, by two women, Tessa and Sasha, originally to deal with the problem of food waste in the home. The reason that that was our focus is that in the UK, which is broadly typical of the Western world, around 70% of food waste is occurring in people's homes. And so if you want to be the sort of truly transformational company that we aim to be, and you're going to tackle food waste, then you need to be making a difference at the household level. However, pretty soon after we were set up, we realized that there was something of a problem, namely that our early adopters, so the people that are most naturally drawn to an app like Olio, were all people who hated food waste, which meant that they didn't generate any. So we had this like growing user base full of like super passionate and engaged users, but there was never any food available because the people that we'd recruited to this user base were like precisely those people that were the least likely to ever have any food left over to share on our platform. And so what we realized we had to do was to find a way to harness this passion and enthusiasm in a way that could bring supply onto the app and on the logic that our users, our early users, had a fair amount of time on their hands, but no food available, whereas businesses had quite a lot of surplus food available, but no time on their hands. We figured we could bring them together in a way that really works for everyone. And that's what we call the Food Waste Hero Program. So the Food Waste Hero Program today involves matching our pool of around 80,000 fully trained volunteers with nearby businesses. These businesses could be schools, offices, retailers, supermarkets, really any business that produces any amount of surplus food. Our volunteers will attend these businesses at an agreed time. It's generally closing time, the end of lunch service, whenever the food would otherwise be thrown away. They'll collect any food that's left unsold, and then they'll take it home to redistribute among their local community from their own home via the Olio app.
Amazing. It's awesome how the concept has evolved. And obviously, it sounds like you joined just at that kind of inflection point when you were launching the kind of B2B side of the business. I'm right in thinking you were pretty much like first boots on the ground in terms of that initial sales hire.
Yeah, so I was the first salesperson hired back in, I think, 2018. And my job initially was to go around local businesses, so convenience stores, bakeries, like independents, and get them to give us their food for free. The position of the Food Waste Hero program within Olio at that point was purely as a way of bringing supply onto the app. We didn't care if we made any money from it. We just needed supply. We needed the food, on the logic as well that users, once they've requested food via the volunteer program, i.e. once they've picked up food that 5 minutes ago had a commercial value attached to it. So really, it was just a way of kickstarting that flywheel, incentivizing people to share their leftover lasagna or whatever. Like, fundamentally, it's quite a strange thing that we're asking people to do, which is to go around to strangers' houses and pick up their spare food. So we have to find a way of creating an incentive for that. But over time, the Food Waste Hero program evolved into one of our major revenue streams. It's one of the things that's quite interesting about Olio, I think. We have quite strong sort of like ethical commitments, and there are certain principles that we follow. And those are the sort of like boundaries within which we have to make a sustainable business. So for example, we don't sell food. There will always be free food available on Olio. We don't use advertising on the platform because we don't want to turn our users into the product. And so we have to constantly innovate to try to find ways to make money. And after a little while, after having the Food Waste Hero program set up, we realized that there was appetite to pay, that supermarkets like Tesco and Waitrose in Iceland, for example, would be willing to pay for a service like the Food Waste Hero program.
And am I right in thinking that's largely because they're having to pay to dispose of this unused food anyway?
Yeah, exactly. There's sort of two drivers of it. One is their sustainability and CSR targets and commitments. So every business has to reach net zero. Very hard to reach net zero as a food business if you're throwing away a really large percentage of the food that you produce. And the other is they have, again, quite significant waste disposal costs. So a business like Tesco will spend a lot of money every year just having their food picked up and taken to anaerobic digestion or thrown away. And so our argument is, why not use Olio and actually make some good of that food?
Yeah, I love it. I really do. And we spoke about earlier in your career, Liam, you were in that more kind of like hard-nosed tech sales volume environment. It sounds like the type of sale you're doing at Olio is much more kind of mission driven and quite a different environment to be operating in. A lot of our listeners are working in what would be kind of perceived as quite an aggressive tech sales environment. Just talk our listeners through the kind of differences that you've experienced between selling more of a kind of technology type environment versus the sales process earlier?
Well, one is that people are a lot nicer to you once you're in the tech for good space. I'd say you still get the same amount of no's, but the no's are much communicated in a much sort of kinder way. Another major difference is the kind of people that you're around. The tech for good space just attracts a different kind of person to the more sort of hard-nosed traditional sales space. But that can be a problem, especially as a sales leader, is you need to check that the fundamental skills that you need on both sides are the same. You need to be resilient, persistent, organized, driven, all of those kind of things. It doesn't really matter whether you're in a traditional tech sales environment or in the tech for good space. Yeah, a company like Olio attracts a lot of people who want to do it for the ethical reasons, but you need to make sure that they still have the skills to actually do the job.
Yeah, it makes sense. And I was at an EdTech conference last week. One of the things that came out of that was selling to educators requires really high level of kind of empathy and rapport building. And you have to kind of really understand the mission that these educators are on in order to position your solution. You know, I imagine you're selling into quite a lot of kind of CSR type teams and other kind of similar types of skills that you see is really important.
Yeah, the thing is, I think that can be a bit of a red herring because you're still asking for an investment on the part of the prospect. They still need to get the green light from higher up. They're still going to need somebody at the director level to say yes, which means that you can't rely entirely on making a sort of principled case for a business to work with you. You have to show them what's in it for them commercially, how it benefits their reputation and ultimately their bottom line.
It makes a lot of sense. There still has to be a business case justification. So talk us through the transition, Liam. You know, you came in kind of first boots on the ground. You've started building out the B2B side, the supply side of the platform. Talk us through the transition when you moved into kind of like a leadership role and then you actually started hiring people for the first time.
Yeah, it's a really stark transition. And I think anybody who has made that jump from being an IC to head of BD or running their own team would tell you the same thing. You get good at selling and your reward is that you stop doing it, basically. And the skill set that you need to develop is entirely different. I was quite fortunate in that I got in sort of at the ground floor of Olio. So I grew with the company. But one thing I would say to anybody who is in a similar position now, somebody who might have joined a company as one of their early sales hires, is that it's really important not to sit on your laurels and just assume that as the company grows, you will too. I've seen lots of people who've done that. If you don't develop your skills, if you don't work on yourself and make sure that you're ready to make the jump when the opportunity presents itself, then they won't let you. That won't be the move that you make. As Olio was growing in those first couple of years, I had my eye on where I wanted to be. I wanted to be ahead of BD. And so I was sort of preparing for that move, all the while getting input from mentors and from senior leadership on what I needed to be able to do, what I needed to be able to prove in order to make that transition.
I'd love to just jump into the point you made there around finding mentors, Liam. This is something we hear a lot, right? Is you become a high-performing IC, you get this opportunity to move into leadership, which is awesome. But then kind of no one teaches you how to become a leader, how to become a coach. And it's a completely different skill set, really. Mentors are something that I've experienced in my own career is really, really important. I hear a lot from first-time sales leaders. How can I find a mentor? How did you think about your kind of mentor network and who were those people that you tried to reach out to?
You're absolutely right. It's difficult. Finding mentors is often easier said than done, especially when you're a junior salesperson who doesn't have those connections, who hasn't developed that network yet. It's kind of a chicken and egg thing. You end up with a much wider network once you're already in the more senior position. What I did is I just went to the founders. I spoke to people that I had connections with who had a vested interest in my development. And I asked them to hook me up with people that they thought I could learn from. And yeah, that's where I found my mentors.
That's a great strategy. Makes a lot of sense. And then once the mentor-mentee relationship had begun, another thing I hear a lot of is like, how do you nurture it? How do you keep it going? How have you thought about that?
That's another great question. One thing I learned is that the first few times I would just have sort of like a monthly check-in or a bi-weekly or whatever and put an hour in the diary or half an hour in the diary. And sometimes you don't have anything to talk about, which means that you end up forcing it. And on both sides, it can become a little bit awkward and not the most productive.
Yeah.
What I think works a lot better is to have that initial chat, explain what you want to get out of it, talk about where you think the mentor that you're speaking to can help you, and then try to establish a sort of as and when relationship. Those have been the most productive for me, at least. I love having people that I can turn to and say, hey, I've got this quite specific problem. I'd love to get your input on it, rather than having just sort of a monthly check-in. But that's just me.
I think it's great advice. There's no need to kind of waste anyone's time. One other thing that I've heard quite a lot around that kind of mentor-mentee relationship is also making sure if your mentor gives you some perspective or advice on how to handle a situation, making sure that once you test it out, you get back in touch with them. You let them know how it's gone. Because I think a lot of people fail to kind of close that loop.
100%. And I think if you just think about it from the perspective of, like, if you're the mentor and you're giving somebody advice, you want to know if it's useful or not. So yeah, 100% agree with that.
So you've lined up your mentor network. You've had the offer to move into the leadership position. How do you now start developing some of the skills that are needed? Obviously, there's going to be a lot of learning on the job. Was there anything else that you did kind of outside of that to start to develop your own skill set?
I mean, it was really just reading, listening to podcasts. The first step was hiring. So that was the first thing that I started to think about is, okay, what do I value in a salesperson? What is it that I'm looking for? And that actually helps to set you up, I think, for your career as a sales leader. The first thing you're dealing with is, okay, what do I think great sales is? What kind of profile, what kind of person am I looking for in this team, especially my first few hires in this team? And once the team was set up, I was very, and I continue to be very open with them, that I was much closer, and I still am much closer to the beginning of this journey than the end, and that I need feedback. That the people that I manage play a bigger role than anyone or anything in shaping my leadership style. And so I constantly invite feedback from the people that I manage. And I try to make sure that it's a collaborative effort, creating the team environment that we have.
That feedback point feels really, really important. It's not an easy thing to do. For our listeners out there, you know, who are perhaps early in their leadership career, I think it takes quite a lot of humility and confidence to kind of transparently ask for feedback. Any kind of words of advice, Liam? Like, how do you go about that process with your team?
So just at Olio in general, twice a year, we do 360 feedback sessions where everybody that you work with is invited to give feedback on your performance over the last 6 months anonymously. I mean, firstly, you just need to park your ego at the door if you're going to be a successful sales leader. You can't let feedback, even harsh feedback, or the fear of receiving harsh feedback prevent you from getting it in the first place. That's just part of the job. But what I do is I just try to build it into everything that we do. So for example, we have an upskilling session every Friday for the whole sales team. I'll recommend a podcast or an article or a book or something and set some questions around it. We'll discuss it, talk about it, answer the questions that I've set, and then I'll ask them to give me a rating for the session so that over time it improves and improves and improves until it's amazing. I try to do the same with everything. So weekly call on a Monday, constantly asking them, restructure it, try new things, and just constantly asking the team to let me know what they think. Pretty simple, really.
I love it. It's simple, but it sounds like it's consistent.
So the other thing is creating an environment where people feel comfortable sharing feedback. I like to think that nobody in my team would be scared or nervous to raise any issues with me, but that's absolutely key. You do not want to create an environment where people feel inhibited or scared.
Yeah, absolutely. I had a conversation with a leader who spoke about one really useful tactical way to get your team to open up is to actually be vulnerable yourself as a leader. So actually kind of opening up and sharing kind of concerns and challenges that you have as a leader builds that trust and helps your team feel more comfortable.
Yeah, absolutely would agree with that. So we have a quarterly business review every 3 months. We just had that. And as part of the quarterly business review, I will talk about my own performance over the quarter, where I think I could have done better. And then I'll invite the team to talk about what they think I did well and badly over the last 3 months.
Love it. Some really great tactical stuff in there. Sales hiring. You mentioned it there, Liam. So obviously a really important part of the role and still one of the hardest things to do as a sales leader. I read a statistic last week. I think the average cost of a bad sales hire is $380,000. I mean, just walk us through your process. How did you as a first-time sales leader start to think about the hiring process and how did you think about trying to de-risk those early hires?
So I got it wrong a lot at the start. I was winging it, to be honest, right at the start. I think everybody who works in sales understands the difficulty of hiring salespeople, that even a middling to poor salesperson is generally going to be fairly convincing in an interview setting. And yeah, I made a couple of poor hires initially, and that's what inspired me to create a more sort of structured way of hiring. The first thing I did was I wrote down the key traits that I'm looking for from a sales hire in my team. So things like curiosity, growth mindset, coachability is an absolutely key one for me. And then I gave them all a sort of weighted score. So this is what I do now when I interview salespeople, is I mark them against the criteria that I've set for like a successful sales hire at Olio. The intention of that is to try and take the sort of personal element out of it, is to prevent me from being seduced by a smooth talking salesperson. We're not perfect at hiring yet. It's an ongoing process.
It's a really sound approach. There's a lot to learn there for first-time leaders around just having some form of scorecard. Doesn't matter how kind of complex or robust it is, but just having something that you can score candidates against, because we see so many leaders flying blind when it comes to hiring. It's a risky business. So you've made your early hires, you've learned from some mistakes, you've now got your scorecard. I mean, reflecting on some of the good hires that you've made, what are some of the differences looking back versus the ones that perhaps didn't work out?
So the way I see it is there are sort of two areas that a salesperson needs to excel in. There's the time spent with prospects and clients, and then there's the time spent on their own. And the time that they spend on their own, the kind of skills that you need there are really just to do with being diligent and organized and persistent, resilient, all of those kinds of things. And the time spent with the client, I think the skills that make a great salesperson are on a sales call are almost exactly the same skills that make a great listener. There's a sort of stereotype of the salesperson as a chancer or a, I think you know what I mean by the smooth talking, super gregarious salesperson. And those people do exist. There are some salespeople that just sort of invite people in and people like spending time with them and it makes them successful. But much more common are salespeople who are great because they're great listeners and because they're organized and diligent and resilient.
I love the way that you think about the two sides. The other observation I've made is that quite often as leaders, we're perhaps guilty of focusing too much of the customer-facing side of the role. Yeah, and actually, you know, in our experience, the things that are happening in your customer conversations are only one piece of the jigsaw puzzle. And there's a hell of a lot that goes on behind the scenes or outside of those interactions that can determine success. You hit the nail on the head, especially with the kind of junior salespeople, making sure that they have built competence in some fundamental areas like managing their time, being able to consistently run their days, being resilient and persistent and being able to handle setbacks. And you quite often in our experience can tell pretty early on if a candidate is not a good hire, if they score low in some of those software areas. Liam, there's been an awesome journey walking through the kind of phases of your evolution and some amazing golden nuggets that you shared with the audience today. I guess the kind of like final question I'd love us to end on is, I guess, reflecting back on your journey so far, what's kind of one thing that really sticks out to you that you wish you had known when you made that move from IC to leader?
One thing that I've noticed running a team that's really important is focus. So making sure that people understand exactly what their job is from the off. I find that people, especially high-performing people, excel when they're given ownership and some freedom. And in order for them to have that, you need to give them a very clear understanding, a very clear task. So their own sector, their own thing to manage.
That makes sense. So just basically what I'm hearing there is just be really clear in terms of your expectations of your team and set them really clear objectives.
Yeah.
It's also interesting reflecting. So we're recording this episode in April 2023. It's been a tough 6 months for a lot of technology businesses. And I read some US data last week that shows that it's almost like the tech bubble has burst. But the US economy for non-tech organizations is still pretty strong. So I think non-tech sector added almost 250,000 jobs. Tech sector has kind of obviously made a lot of redundancies, let a lot of people go. So we're fortunate in a way that we work in sales. Our roles are kind of closely tied to ROI. Therefore, salespeople tend to be the last to go. But thinking about like your journey with Olio, I'm seeing on my LinkedIn network a lot of people being let go recently. And I wonder whether a lot of salespeople are now looking at the tech scene and thinking, well, actually, maybe I want to work in something that's more mission-driven, that really is kind of meaningful and making meaningful change. Are you optimistic about that, Liam? And obviously the team you're building at Olio, and are you starting to see more interest from candidates in the market?
Yes, I think one thing that we benefit from is that it's not an especially crowded marketplace. A discerning salesperson looking for a new job should make sure that whoever they're joining is number one or number two. You don't want to join number four or number five. Yeah, the kind of sector that we're in redistributing surplus food is pretty niche. And so clever salespeople spot that and realize that there's an opportunity there. We're VC funded, so we're not sort of immune to the broader economic environment. But Olio benefits from being a very well-run company. The founders are not some tech company, a whole sort of like a to-the-moon mentality, raise £1 billion and spend it on whatever is like the antithesis of what we do at Olio. We're very careful about how we spend our money. The zero waste mentality extends to time, resources, money, not just food. So we are on a more sure footing than some tech companies because of that. But yeah, I think there are also just as a generation, there are a lot of people that I've seen that are sort of just increasingly keen to get involved in tech for good. They want to work in sustainability or something that has a sort of obvious benefit to the world. Certainly that is one of the major benefits of working at Olio, is that you can reflect on your work and it's not just, here's how much money I made last month. It's here's how many people are eating next month because of the work that I did. Here's how much CO2 is being drawn down from the atmosphere because of the work that I did. So that's something as well that I tell my team. We go over that every week, not just their financial impact, but their environmental and social impact as well. So for people that are looking for that kind of role, Olio is an attractive option. Absolutely.
Exciting times ahead. It's great to hear. I've really enjoyed our conversation today, Liam, and appreciate you coming on the show and sharing transparently your highs, your lows, and some really kind of tactical lessons for our listeners out there. But anyone that's listening to this show when it goes live, if they'd like to reach out and learn more from you, Liam, or learn more about Olio, where's the best place for our listeners to do that?
You can find me on LinkedIn, or if you want to reach out to me directly, that's also fine. Liam@olioex.com. Always happy to chat to fellow sales professionals.
Awesome. Liam, really appreciate you taking the time and enjoyed the chat.
Cheers, Matt.
By uncovering blind spots on performance, motivation, and skills, UHubs helps busy sales leaders at top SaaS companies to optimize their sales enablements so that they can develop reps and grow revenue. The UHubs Pulse platform visualizes each team's development needs, personalized upskilling, and provides data-driven coaching recommendations. These save sales managers 40-plus hours per quarter and help reps to ramp up 30% faster. Supercharge your sales team by booking a demo today.